Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And our big story today is the ceasefire between Israel and Hezbollah that came into force in the early hours of this morning. As is often the way with these truces, there was a significant uptick in violence just before it began. But so far, it does seem to be holding. It follows more than 30 months of fighting between Israel and the Iran-backed militia that began the day after the Hamas attacks of October the 7th. That prompted tens of thousands of people to flee their homes on both sides of the border and thousands to die, particularly in the past 2 months when Israel began its bombardment of Hezbollah positions and sent in troops across the border. Well, under the agreement, those troops have 60 days to head back into Israel. Hezbollah also has to move its fighters and weapons about 30 kilometres north of the border to the other side of the Litani River in southern Lebanon. And it'll be up to the Lebanese army, the UN force that was monitoring the last truce back in 2006, as well as the US and France, to make sure it sticks. Well, NewsHour's been hearing from two people displaced by the past year of fighting. Sarah Ramal is a content creator on Instagram. She was displaced from her Lebanese village right on the border with Israel. What does she think of the ceasefire?
I don't trust that the ceasefire will continue because I just don't trust anything Israelis say. Hezbollah isn't just an organization of people who have goals they want to achieve. Hezbollah is a resistance, and when you attack people, they will resist. That's an idea, and you can't kill ideas. I am very confident that I will go back to my village. My village is fully bombed right now, but we are going back and we are rebuilding it because we are going back to our homes that we built and we grew up in.
And Dr. Paula Pitashny is a biochemist from the Israeli town of Matula, right on the border. She was forced to leave and now lives in the centre of Israel. So does she take any reassurance from the news?
I will not go back to Matula to live because it's not safety and not secure. Because I think the ceasefire it's not a good solution. I'm against the war, but they started a war because the connection with Gaza. And if the ceasefire will not include ceasefire with Gaza and the release of the hostages, of 101 hostages, this is not a good agreement. I think it will be a disaster.
Well, since the truce was announced, thousands of people in Lebanon have been on the move, heading south to their homes. The Israeli military and the Lebanese authorities have both warned them that it's not yet safe to return. But that hasn't stopped them. Huge traffic jams have formed on the main road from the capital, Beirut, heading south. The BBC's Hugo Bashega joined those travelling from the city, also got stuck in traffic earlier near the city of Sidon.
This is the main road between Beirut and the south of the country. And for hours since this ceasefire came into effect, thousands of people have been trying to go back to their homes. Families, people carrying their belongings, lots of mattresses here. People are waving and carrying flags, Hezbollah flags, and also posters with the face of the late leader Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Beirut. This happens despite warnings from the Israeli military and also from Lebanese authorities telling people not to go back to their homes now. This is a gradual withdrawal of Israeli forces from the south of the country. And people here are telling us that they haven't been defeated in this conflict despite the widespread destruction caused by airstrikes and also the massive blows that Hezbollah has suffered. They say that this is a sign of victory.
BBC's Hugo Bashego. So, how does Hezbollah, the Iran-backed militant group, see the truce? Hezbollah, which is designated as a terror organisation by many Western countries, is also a political party in Lebanon. One of its MPs in the Lebanese parliament is Ibrahim Al-Moussawi.
when we see the end of the massacres that are taking place in Gaza and Lebanon and in different places, even in the West Bank, when we see the end of the occupation, when we see that the justice has taken place, when we see that the international community, the United Nations, the Security Council has assumed its proper role against the occupation and against this genocide taking place in Gaza and was taking place in Lebanon. This is the way any honest and any straightforward person would be satisfied.
And what did that achieve from your point of view? Because from the outside, it looks like many people in Lebanon have lost their lives, many people have lost their homes, and large parts of the country now lie in ruins.
You should ask, what did the international community do? What did the international organization, the United Nations, the Security Council, the superpowers, the United States that always boast about democracy and the human rights, the Europe and other countries, what did they do to stop this genocide? When you go and act in order to assist the people who are under genocide, you do not ask yourself, what's going to happen to me? Because you have to enact justice. I don't know whether you accept or not.
But would you admit, though, that it has been a disaster for Hezbollah? You've suffered many losses, including the deaths of most of your leaders, haven't you?
True, but I can tell you, you have to judge the results. The Israelis, when they started this war, they said that they want to crush Hezbollah, and they said equally they want to bring back the settlers into the occupied territories in northern Palestine by force, and they couldn't do it, but by indirect negotiations. So when you see the result, I believe this tells you something, doesn't it?
Will Hezbollah abide by its side of the agreement and dismantle completely its military infrastructure in southern Lebanon?
We announced that we accepted and we comply with the 1701.
Right, but the point is 1701 didn't last and you didn't comply with it and built up a huge amount of military infrastructure in southern Lebanon. Will you now dismantle that, though?
The 1701 has been violated thousands of times by the Israelis, and it is there that they have to withdraw from Shib'a Farms, from Farshuba Hills, and from other occupied territories. The Israelis didn't do their part.
Sure, and those are questions we will put to the Israeli government. But just in terms of Hezbollah's military infrastructure, will that now be completely dismantled south of the Litani River?
We have accepted to comply with the 1701, and you have the explanation.
Are you happy with what Israel has said in the past 24 hours, that it reserves the right to attack Hezbollah in southern Lebanon if they see violations of the ceasefire agreement? In other words,
we have our right of defense, self-defense, and to defend our occupied territories against any attack from the Israeli side. I believe we have the right to defend ourselves.
Did Hezbollah accept this deal because it realized that it couldn't carry on fighting Israel?
We accepted this deal because we wanted to see the end of the carnage and the genocide against the civilians. You know, as I know, as all the whole world know, that 70% of those who were killed, even 80%, are children and women, and the Israelis are targeting civilians. So I accepted it because we want to see an end for this ongoing genocide.
Israel says that the reason so many civilians, including women and children, were killed was because Hezbollah had placed itself right in the heart of those communities in southern Lebanon.
If you are convinced with the Israeli propaganda, then you are a victim of it. This is victimizing the truth, I believe, in this. When you talk about the people, do we kill our own people? Who just go and see who were killed, actually? You're talking about our families. How could we put our families in such a position? No, I would tell you that the Israelis would target a whole residential area of 18 or 12 floors just to kill one person.
Hezbollah Member of Parliament Ibrahim al-Moussawi. Well, let's hear from Israel. Moshe Topaz is an Israeli member of the Knesset, or Parliament, with the centrist opposition Yesh Atid party. Is he happy with this deal?
The ceasefire was needed. Israel had to reach a ceasefire after 14 months of fighting. And I think both terror organizations, both Hamas and Hezbollah, wanted it. We have only a ceasefire with Hezbollah, which wants to rebuild its forces. But I do hope we will see in close time also the Hamas coming to an agreement and bringing back 101 hostages that are still in Hamas hands in Gaza.
What about the people of northern Israel? Is it going to be soon safe for them to return to their homes, do you believe?
I hope so. That's a big test. I mean, that's the main reason there was an agenda in Israel to return these tens of thousands of people who have had to leave their homes, their refugees in our country today. So I do hope that will be the big test, the big exam of the situation. And the second one will be, will Israel manage to prevent Hezbollah coming back to the border with Israel? I hope the new agreement will prevent that.
And that has been one of the criticisms, for example, of the former Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, not one of your political bedfellows, but he says Hezbollah still has tens of thousands of rockets in its stockpile and can continue to rearm.
He's right. He's right. And that's a big threat. And we have to prevent that. And we see the agenda of the countries that are involved in this agreement, the United States, France and other countries, to be the allies that will prevent the terror organizations shooting at Israel and threatening its civilians.
So what has actually changed since the last agreement nearly 20 years ago that arguably led up to the current situation? What is different about this agreement that means that in another 20 years, there's not going to be another war between Israel and Hezbollah?
Look, there's no way to prevent that. But it all goes back to Iran. Iran built its proxy organizations, armed them, gave them lots of money to do terror actions and to shoot at Israel. And with its allies today, where Iran is a big ally of Russia, that's a big danger to the peace of the world. So we have to make sure Iran is weakened and doesn't take the way to terror as it's done in the last decade or so.
Lebanon and the Lebanese people have paid a huge price for this. Thousands of people have died. Many people have lost their homes, possibly forever. Was it worth it, do you think, in terms of the cost in lives and property and the destruction that it's done to your neighbor?
Israel didn't take an action before Hezbollah acted. Israel was attacked on the 7th of October by Hamas. And the day after that, Hezbollah joined in. Israel had to defend itself. And 2 months ago, we had to actually move in order to move out the Hezbollah terrorists. So the only ones to blame for the situation of Lebanon is Hezbollah and its people that overtook Lebanon as their hostages. And we're telling the Lebanese people, we would love to have a peace agreement with you, but you have to take over the forces that Hezbollah built in Lebanon. That's a huge question. I think it will demand the big Western countries, England, America, and France, to be involved in rebuilding Lebanon and making it again a democratic country, not in the hands of a terror organization like Hezbollah.
That was Moshe Topaz, Israeli member of the Knesset with the Yesh Atid party. We'll be having more on this story in about 15 minutes here on NewsHour. Also coming up on the programme, the picturesque seaside town in New Zealand invaded by a malodorous menace.
It really is a mixture between excrement and a kind of chemically sort of smell that you can really taste at the back of your throat as well. That is really the best way I can put it for you without going further into detail.
More on that coming up in just over 10 minutes. Our main headlines from the newsroom once again. Hours after the Israel and Hezbollah ceasefire came into force, thousands of displaced people have defied security warnings to return to their homes in southern Lebanon. Georgia's pro-Russia governing parties nominated a former footballer turned right-wing politician as its choice for president. And the Canadian rapper Drake's filed a second legal action in as many days against the record label Universal Music, claiming a track by rival rapper Kendrick Lamar is defamatory. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. The International Criminal Court has been busy. Last week, it issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former defence minister, and one of Hamas's top commanders. Well, now the court's chief prosecutor has requested an arrest warrant for the military leader of Myanmar, Min Aung Hlaing, for alleged crimes against humanity against the country's Rohingya Muslims. Tens of thousands of Rohingya were killed by the army in 2017. Hundreds of thousands had to flee to neighbouring Bangladesh. The BBC's Southeast Asia correspondent is Jonathan Head. Why has it taken so long to request this arrest warrant?
Well, it took a very long time to get internationally led investigations going in Myanmar. The then government, which of course was an elected government back then, although the atrocities, alleged atrocities against the Rohingyas were carried out by the military, was not willing to cooperate. There was a fact-finding mission. When nothing was forthcoming on the Myanmar side, eventually they wanted to refer this case to the International Criminal Court. That was difficult because Myanmar's not a signatory. Now, you can overrule that if all five permanent members of the UN Security Council agree, but they don't. China and Russia are broadly supportive of Myanmar. And so it's actually been quite a skillful legal sleight of hand that the prosecutor has used at the ICC, arguing that although Myanmar's not a signatory, because the Rohingyas were by and large driven over the border into Bangladesh, the crimes also occurred there, and Bangladesh is a signatory. But for all that, they've been investigating for 5 years. It's typically how long it takes.
What exactly is Min Aung Hlaing accused of doing?
Well, the prosecutor, the chief prosecutor, Karim Khan, says that from all the evidence he's gathered, there are clear grounds for saying that Min Aung Hlaing is responsible, and the crimes he's highlighted are persecution and deportation. Now, human rights groups will point out that it's a fairly broad term, but that actually kind of excludes some of the very worst things that were done to the Rohingyas back in August of 2017, when there was mass rape, dreadful, and a murder of children, mass murder of villagers, villages burnt down. But because those crimes happened exclusively in Myanmar, it would be difficult for the prosecutor to include those. But he can include persecution, the kind of discriminatory laws and the attacks on the Rohingyas that drove them into Bangladesh, and then forced deportation. And, you know, there isn't any doubt that Min Aung Hlaing, who, of course, is now the coup leader, the leader of the government, was in a position of responsibility. He was head of the armed forces. He even made comments at the time that implied that he felt the Rohingyas needed to be dealt with in a very tough way as the military was sweeping through these villages and burning them down.
And what is the status of those hundreds of thousands of Rohingyas who had to flee to Bangladesh? I mean, is the assumption that they'll have to stay there until things change back in Myanmar, that they're effectively stranded there?
Well, there's always been an assumption that the Bangladesh government has stuck to, that they are there temporarily. It makes life very difficult because Bangladesh doesn't want them seeping into the mainstream Bangladesh population, looking for jobs, settling down. They're confined to these dreadfully overcrowded and very squalid camps. And Bangladesh has always argued, you know, we're already a poor and overcrowded country. We shouldn't have to accommodate them. They should go back. But they can't go back. Even before the coup, the situation in Rakhine State was frankly impossible for them to go back. It was clear that the Rakhine Buddhist population didn't particularly want them back. The military was still hostile, and there was simply no way of ensuring their safety. So, to all intents and purposes, there's no practical way they can go back. But honestly, their situation is absolutely dire. I mean, even by the wretched standards that you see in much of the world today, they're stuck either in these ghastly camps in Bangladesh or still caught in fighting and persecuted in Rakhine State. Their situation has not improved since 2017, and arguably it's got a lot worse.
And that was the BBC Southeast Asia correspondent Jonathan Head speaking to me from Bangkok. Let's head to France now, because today is the final day of the trial of the far-right leader and presidential hopeful Marine Le Pen. She and 24 others are accused of embezzling millions of euros of European Union funds to pay for work undertaken by her National Rally Party within France and not in Brussels. If convicted, she could face prison and a ban on running for office for several years. Let's talk to Sophie Padder, Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist. Sophie, as ever, good to have you with us here on the programme. Her lawyer's been in court today making closing arguments. What is her defence?
Well, her defence is that they were doing perfectly legitimate work at the same time as having a role in the National Party. The point was that she is going to argue that they were doing legitimate tasks for the European Parliament. It's going to be a difficult case for her to make, I think, because we've heard the prosecutors cite evidence that some of the assistants concerned, you know, hardly turned up at all at the European Parliament. And this is something that was going on for years. So it's going to be a tough case to make, but she is really, this is her last chance to try to persuade the judges and not to find her guilty and go for the full sentence, which would be extremely difficult.
Yeah, and we won't get a verdict, I don't think, until early in the new year. And there are sort of different options for the sentences. I mean, how likely is it, first of all, she'll be banned from running for office?
Well, I think the main thing to understand is that if she's found guilty, the judges under France's new anti-corruption laws, well, they came in 2016, so they're not that new anymore, but they feel it in the sort of French political system. She has to apply the maximum penalty. So she will be banned for 5 years. But the discretion concerns whether or not that sentence is applied with immediate effect. In other words, if in January the judges say, OK, no immediate effect, but we are handing down this sentence, then Marine Le Pen can appeal, and that will drag out over years. So under that scenario, Marine Le Pen can remain in politics and she can probably run for the presidency in 2027. If, on the other hand, the judges say, no, this is having an immediate effect, your sentence is applying from day one now, then it upends everything in France and Marine Le Pen will be ineligible for 5 years. That is what this all really hinges on.
Meanwhile, I mean, just thinking about the immediate future, I mean, she remains a powerful figure politically in France, doesn't she? And could well, what, topple the government over its proposed budget?
She does, because she holds the balance of power in a way in the parliament. She isn't the biggest group, the biggest bloc, but there is no bloc that holds a minority in parliament. And Michel Barnier has been trying to get through his budget for 2025. He's got a deadline of December 21st, which is coming up very fast. And it looks extremely unlikely that he'll get it through without using a special constitutional provision in France, which he can use to force it through. So he'd force through the budget without a direct vote. That would prompt a no confidence vote. And if she and Marine Le Pen and her party vote for it, it would bring down the government, because it's pretty much going to sure that the left will vote. So together they could bring down the government. And that's what's going on at the moment. It's an extraordinary moment where she is both sort of, seeing her own judicial future in the balance, but also she holds the keys to the future of the French government.
And if it does fall, I mean, what? That means fresh elections.
Well, do you know, it doesn't actually, not immediately, because, again, under the French constitution, the president can't dissolve the National Assembly again until next summer. So what it does mean is we go back to the situation we had in France during this summer, which is where for weeks and weeks we were watching President Macron try desperately to find a prime minister who had, you know, the chance of commanding some form of majority in parliament. And that's what he could just put Michel Barnier back in the job and name him again, but it would be with the same problem that he has at the moment, or he could try something different. But none of the options look very good or very easy for him.
Sophie, thank you very much indeed. Sophie Petter, Paris Bureau Chief for The Economist there. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. We've got lots more coming up in the second half of the programme. Don't go away. Welcome back to NewsHour. Pity the poor residents of Hutt Valley, a seaside community near New Zealand's capital, Wellington. They've been living with a terrible smell that's descended over parts of the town for a number of years because of a faulty water treatment plant. That is going to be fixed, but it'll take 4 years, and even then, they were told at a public meeting this week, the stink will probably still be there. Some say it's ruined their lives and are thinking of moving away. Ashley McCall's been covering the story for Radio New Zealand. First of all, just how bad is the stench?
I have been around the streets of Seaview, and to be honest, I tried my hardest not to gag myself the first time I went there. So if that was just my first reaction, I really do feel for those residents who live on that street. It really is a mixture between excrement and a kind of chemically sort of smell that you can really taste at the back of your throat as well. That is really the best way I can put it for you without going further into detail.
Yeah, and what caused the original smell? This was malfunctioning equipment at this water treatment plant, is that right?
Yeah, so problems arose last year where one of their biofilters failed, and then it actually started to cause some of that odour to go across the Lower Hutt suburb. Then, although that equipment was then replaced, in September what happened was the dryer then caught on fire, and then subsequently to that, one of the other machinery caused a backlog of sludge to happen. That meant there was more odour than going across the suburb. So residents were told that they're going to have to put up with this for another 4 years while they actually work to try and replace that dryer. But that same dryer has to still operate in the meantime.
4 years? I mean, why so long? People must be furious about this.
Yes, it was a very fiery council meeting, that public community meeting that I went to the other day. When I spoke to the officials afterwards saying how they thought the meeting went, they said, oh, it could have been worse. People were actually rather patient. But there was a bit of swearing from some of the locals, as you can imagine. There were also tears from some of the people in the audience. And when I asked them why they got so upset, they mentioned that basically they felt that their livelihoods are almost being stripped away from them. Businesses were saying how they're losing customers because they don't want to come anywhere near the smell.
This should be a lovely place, shouldn't it? I mean, it's effectively a sort of suburb of Wellington, isn't it? And it's by the sea. I mean, it should be a nice place to live. But everything you've told me suggests that it's a very horrible place to live at the moment.
Well, when I was going around the suburb, it actually is a very beautiful looking suburb. So where the smell is, it's situated in a very industrial sort of area. But when you travel further away from it into the more residential part, that's actually where I notice the smell felt worse to me compared to being right next to the plant, funnily enough. It is, though, it's a beautiful residential area, but that odour really is putting a real dampener on it for the community.
I bet. That was local reporter Ashley McCall. You're listening to NewsHour. This is NewsHour live from the BBC in London. I'm James Menendez. Let's return for a few minutes to our main story now, the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon. Colin Sheridan is a retired army major who served with the Irish Defence Forces from 1997 to 2023, including 3 years with the UN's Lebanese peacekeeping force, UNIFIL. That was formed to patrol the last truce that followed a brief war in 2006. Indeed, the outlines of today's agreement are essentially the same as the one back then, known as UN Security Council Resolution 1701. So, is it all a question of enforcement?
To be optimistic about it, the hope would be that if you allow UNIFIL, again with the support of the Lebanese armed forces, to implement 1701 properly and possibly as it should have been over the last 18 years. But that requires Israel to allow UNIFIL to do its job, and it also requires Hezbollah to agree with those terms and withdraw from an area that is essentially sacred ground in Lebanon for them. We're also seeing scenes today already of this mass return of people back to the south while Israeli military are still present there. I expect that there will be outbreaks of violence that will undoubtedly, to Israel's mind, be a violation of this peace agreement, and then more violence will follow from that. If you're trying to be optimistic and you're trying to say that the UNIFIL be allowed to do its job in conjunction with the Lebanese armed forces, and if they're fully supported in that by the international community, then sure. But we also have to recognize that Israel especially has undermined UNIFIL consistently, again, long before the current 2 month period of them invading Lebanon. So it would require Israel to allow UNIFIL do its job.
Many people have blamed UNIFIL, at least partly, for the failure of the last agreement. Was it that they weren't able to enforce that agreement or not willing?
Certainly, I don't think it was a willpower issue, having worked with UNIFIL and been on the ground in Lebanon for quite some time. I think the will was always there to enforce 1701. If you're to look at it from the tactical reasons on the ground, there are many gaps in what UNIFIL did and achieved over the last 18 years since the end of the 2006 war that allowed Hezbollah undoubtedly rebuild, reconstitute itself over a long period of time. And I think Hezbollah has been quite good at playing the long game in that regard. First of all, you had the rebuild in the south after 2006. You know, these tunnel networks that Israel has accused UNIFIL of turning a blind eye to. I don't think they allowed it or turned a blind eye to it. I think it comes down to a few things. And one of them is Hezbollah operating on their own turf. It also comes down to UNIFIL, 10,000 troops across 50 or so troop contributing nations. Peacekeeping has a nuance to it that is separate to war fighting. You'll have some nations that are good at peacekeeping, and by that I mean they're good at engaging with local communities in a way that allows them to ascertain what is happening. But there's also some prohibitive factors, we'll say, that would prevent UNIFIL from doing their job, in the sense that Hezbollah know the ground. UNIFIL would not be as able to observe and report what Hezbollah is doing after dark. I think especially when you have long periods of relative peace like we've had between 2006 and 2024, this is human nature, that there's complacency in peacekeeping, that there's complacency in implementation of the mandate. There's been various times over that 18-year period that both Israel and Lebanon have called for UNIFIL numbers to be reduced. Now, all of a sudden, UNIFIL numbers will probably need to be bolstered. The other issue there, of course, is the abilities and the capabilities of the Lebanese armed forces and the expectation that will fall on them now in the coming months.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, to what extent is the Lebanese army, given that it's presumably not the strongest fighting force and it serves a pretty weak government, to what extent will they be able to implement this agreement?
I would be very dubious and skeptical about how they will be able to do it. The Lebanese armed forces from 2012 on has been very active and under an awful lot of pressure along the Syrian border. It never had to worry about the south, notwithstanding its commitment to working alongside UNIFIL, because from the point of view of defending Lebanon, that was always Hezbollah would do it. So this is going to require huge investment to the Lebanese armed forces. And we have to remember that the US is the largest military donor, both to Israel and to Lebanon. Obviously, they give far less to Lebanon than they do to Israel. And it will require huge backing from the EU. But this isn't going to happen overnight. It's going to take a very long time. And the Lebanese armed forces, as you rightly point out, is an instrument of a near failed state.
And that was Colin Sheridan, formerly a military officer, for Irish military officers serving in that peacekeeping force, UNIFIL. Now, a small piece of good news for people in war-ravaged Sudan. Some of the obstacles blocking the delivery of much-needed aid look set to be lifted. The breakthrough was negotiated by the UN's new humanitarian chief, Tom Fletcher, on his first trip to Sudan since taking up the post. After 4 days of talks, including a meeting with the country's army chief and de facto leader, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, Mr. Fletcher has obtained permission for the UN to establish new supply hubs and use three additional airports in both government and rebel-held areas. Our chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette, is travelling with him and spoke to him on the plane as he left Port Sudan.
Well, we measure our work in terms of outcomes, and the outcome for us that matters most is lives saved. And so we have those conversations, checkpoint by checkpoint, border by border, permit by permit, and we've made some real progress.
What actually did you achieve in your meeting with the de facto authority, General Burhan?
So I was blessed with a series of meetings over 4 days, including and also the site visits where you and I have seen so much of why this matters. But we've got these extra humanitarian flights that will transport huge amounts of aid to where it's most needed, behind the lines, across those battle lines. But we also got agreement to open up new humanitarian hubs, which will mean that our people can see for themselves what's needed and talk to those affected populations and make sure they're getting the support we need.
But are you asking for even more?
I will always ask for more, because the scale of this crisis demands more. Half of the country are displaced, 25 million people, and so we have to scale up our effort. That means asking much more of donors, asking much more of our own populations, but of course we'll be asking more of the authorities, because we want to get more aid in, we want to get more checkpoints open, we want to get more border crossings open. We want to get this support to those who need it by any means possible.
But you have to deal with the other side in this war too. Is every step forward with the Sudanese armed forces a step backward with their main rival, the Rapid Support Forces, that they're both in battle for the control of Sudan?
It's inevitable that there are trade-offs, and a lot of this is about politics and diplomacy. I'm learning that already in my first week. But I'll go anywhere, talk to anyone to get this aid through and ultimately to save lives. It's worth it.
What do you say to the criticism that the United Nations made a mistake in accepting General Burhan as the de facto authority, which means that in effect you can't do anything unless he gives you permission?
General Burhan and the authorities control those checkpoints. They control the system of permits and access. And so if we want to go into those areas, we need to deal with them. And so we've got to constructive conversation going. We've got a real dialogue. And if that saves lives, then it's worth it.
And that was Tom Fletcher, the UN's humanitarian chief, talking there to the BBC's Lise Doucette. Now, there are still several weeks before he takes office, but Donald Trump is already dipping his toe in the policy pool. He's now threatened to impose a 25% tariff on all products coming from Canada as well as Mexico, both partners in a long-standing free trade agreement. Just to put this in context, more than three-quarters of Canadian exports go to the US. Mr. Trump says he's planning the move in order to force Canada to do more to combat the flow of undocumented migrants and illegal drugs into the US. Doug Ford is Premier of Ontario, Canada's most populous province. NewsHour's Tim Franks asked him what effect he thought these tariffs might have.
These tariffs are going to hurt both countries. They're going to hurt them drastically, the US and Canada and Ontario. Ontario alone, which is our province, largest province, does approximately $500 billion of two-way trade. 9 million Americans wake up every single day to produce products for Ontario alone. Canada does $1.3 trillion of two-way trade, no matter if it's our oil being shipped down or other energy that's being shipped down. That's 60% of what they take in on the energy file, but also the auto sector as well. We're so tied in. And 17 states in the U.S. we're their number one destination. As I say, number one export area is Ontario, and number two to 11 others. So I never hate retaliating, but if he does put these tariffs on, we will retaliate. We will put tariffs on every box of cereal, every cracker, anything that gets shipped across. And I promise you, it will hurt the U.S., and I don't want that.
Sure.
I want to be collaborative. I want to cooperate with them, and let's have a fair trade and free trade.
I guess, I mean, in a sense, you setting out those numbers, particularly in terms of the importance, obviously, of the U.S. as a market for Canadian exports, just sort of makes Donald Trump's case for him, though, doesn't it? That actually this is a very potent threat, and he has made it very clear what he wants. And actually, in contrast to what he's had to say, for example, about trade deficits elsewhere with places like China, it's not about trade. It's about policing the border. And he says you need to do more.
Well, you know something, we have a tremendous amount of illegals coming up through the U.S. into the Canadian borders and crossing there. Make no mistake about it. Can our federal government tighten up our borders? 100%. But he put us in the same bucket as Mexico that have over 2.1 million people coming in the southern border compared to roughly 195,000 people coming from Canada into the U.S. And we've seen tens of thousands of people trying to get up to Canada. We've seen illegal guns come up that people use for heinous crimes. And we know that fentanyl and other hard drugs are coming up through Mexico into California and into Canada at certain ports.
Yeah.
So we need to work together with the law enforcement on both sides of the border. But you can't... You just can't use that as an excuse to slap 25% tariffs on your one of your closest allies. I always say UK, Canada, and the United States have stood shoulder to shoulder in many conflicts around the world, all the way back to World War One. And you just don't slap a family member in the face.
Yeah. Well, you may say that, but it sounds as if that's precisely what he's willing to do. And I mean, the U.S. Officials are saying that, you know, lots more people have come over that northern border from Canada in the last 12 months than in I think the previous 17 years combined, some figure like that. So, I mean, clearly there is more that you can do. You can say you don't like the way in which he's going about it, but it will be a spur to action, won't it?
I agree. I agree 100%, Tim. The federal government needs to beefen up the borders, take care of the Canadian Border Service, put more resources there. Our Royal Canadian Mounted Police, they need to put more resources there. I don't control the border. I wish I did, because people, you wouldn't be able to get a mouse through that border if we were in control of our border.
And that was Doug Ford, who's Premier of Ontario, Canada's most populous province, talking there to my colleague Tim Franks. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Alaa Abdel Fattah is Egypt's best-known political prisoner. A blogger and outspoken pro-democracy activist, he's been in prison for most of the past decade. His latest spell began in 2019. After 2 years in detention, he was convicted of spreading false news after sharing a Facebook page about torture in Egypt. He was sentenced to 5 years, meaning he should have been released in September of this year. But the Egyptian authorities refused to count the more than 2 years he'd been held in pre-trial detention as part of his sentence, and so he remains in jail for at least another 2 years. Well, that decision prompted his British-born mother to go on hunger strike. She hasn't eaten for nearly 2 months now. And today, Leila Swaif has been meeting the British Foreign Secretary David Lammy to discuss Alaa's case. He has joint British and Egyptian citizenship. And Mr. Lammy, before he came into government, was a vocal supporter of the family. I've been speaking to Leila Swaif. So how was the meeting?
It was a bit better than I expected. I mean, I was very sceptical. But Mr. Lammy is now starting to listen to us. I hope we'll get some action soon, because after all, my body has given us a lucky break by being resilient for so long, but we are running out of time.
Did he give you any specific assurances about what action the British government is taking or will take to try to secure Alaa's release?
Not quite. He did give us assurances about his commitment to the case, but we still have to see more positive, concrete action.
And what exactly would you like the British government to do?
Well, we have a number of asks. We have asked him to make the potential UK-Egypt Trade Summit, which the Prime Minister of Egypt is very keen to have conditional on Alaa's release. As I pointed out, we're not asking great things because Alaa has actually finished his sentence. I mean, it's not like we're asking for him to be released before time or anything. So really, it should be doable.
The UK has no consular access to Alaa at the moment, despite him holding a British passport. I mean, is there any progress on that, for example?
We haven't been told that there is progress, but we're hoping to see progress on that. I asked Mr. Lemon specifically to do something about that. Hoping is maybe too strong a word. I wish to see progress on that during the coming days or weeks or something.
And the fact that Britain doesn't have consular access, does that mean it's been almost impossible to find out how Alaa is at the moment?
No, not quite, because we have access to Alaa as a family, but it just means that if there's something bad going on, the Egyptian government can just deny it and claim that we're lying.
Right. So how is he? How is he at the moment?
He's pretty dire. The last time I saw him was on the 18th of November, which was actually his 43rd birthday. So he was pretty down. He was very clear about not wanting to celebrate yet another birthday in jail. Anything, he didn't feel like he was ever going to be let out. I'm seeing him again next Saturday. I'm flying back to Egypt on Friday because his regular monthly visit is on Saturday. I hope to be able to make him a little bit less down, partly because of my meeting with Mr. Lammy and how frank and direct it was, but mainly because of all the media attention and all the support I got from British MPs and so on.
And also, how are you? How are you holding up?
I'm still holding up. I'm still functioning semi-normally. It's the phase where your body burns up extra fat. That's a phase in hunger strikes, which can be quite long. As I said, we're all having, me and Mr. Lammy and even the Egyptian authorities are all having a lucky break that I'm holding up so long, but we really should get on with this before I collapse. Personally, I don't want to collapse. And they're going to have a very embarrassing situation on their hands if I do collapse. And it would then be probably irreversible.
Indeed. I mean, what does Allah think about what you're doing?
He accepts it. He knows me. He knows I don't change my mind when I set my mind in a certain direction. So basically, he accepts it because he knows me.
But, I mean, presumably he wouldn't want you to die trying to push his case before the British government, would he?
No, he wouldn't want me to die. He's very worried about me. But, you know, we both know the Egyptian regime. We know that this regime always expects one to back down, and that if you back down, they sort of run all over you. So he wouldn't want that happening to me either. He wouldn't want my, well, I suppose it's a bit theatrical saying this, but he wouldn't want my spirit to be broken.
No, I'm sure. I mean, do you hold on to the hope that you will live to see your son freed?
I have to hold on to that hope. I keep telling myself that, yes, it will happen. And, well, I suppose if it doesn't happen, I've gambled wrong and I won't be around to worry about it.
Why do you think the Egyptians are so determined to keep your son in jail? I mean, it's been, what, almost 10 years in total, hasn't it?
Partly because it is Allah who is so prominent and so on, but also because they don't want to let anyone out. I mean, I've got a friend who is a university professor. He was a leading Muslim Brotherhood person, but he was a very good university professor, and he was very liberal for a Muslim. He was very liberal, actually, by any measures, and he was found innocent since 2018, and he's still in jail. If they can get away with it, they don't want to let anyone out.
And so why do you think they will possibly back down over Allah's case and look at what you're doing and say, okay, well, this has gone too far? Why do you think they would do that?
Mainly if the British ask them to do it firmly enough, because they don't really want to upset the apple cart with the British. I mean, they need the British and they need their alignment with the West. And also because my present hunger strike is generating a lot of sympathy in Egypt, and it's, you know, putting indirect pressure, maybe, but it is putting pressure on them.
So you do strongly believe that Britain does have leverage over Egypt, and if it exerts that leverage, it will work?
Absolutely, absolutely, absolutely.
And that was Leila Swaif, the mother of Alaa Abd El Fattah, speaking to me a little earlier, just after that meeting with Britain's foreign secretary. And that is it for this edition of NewsHour from me and the rest of the team. Thanks so much for listening. Until the next time. Bye-bye.